We are talking this segment about Cole the Musical, which is presented by Little Globe and the Lensic. Molly Sturgis joins us. She's artistic director and co-composer and lyricist of Cole the Musical. And Camila Thorndike is the director of engagement. There is a work in progress reading this Friday at 7 o'clock at the Lensic. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, MC. It's great to be with you.
Thank you.
So this is, I mean, Cole the Musical. It is literally a musical about climate change, about coal, about mining, about what the heck we're doing right now.
Cole the Musical, I think, is very much also about who we are as humans, what our values are, what are the values that we share, what is the opportunity at this time in the face of this immense paradox and this immense challenge to find out what really matters. And
what do you mean by paradox?
For me, Cole is a really wonderful representation of many of the extractive practices that we're involved in that we benefit from in our phones, our clothes, so many other forms, that things that inform our life or that we have in our life. But it's also, it powers our world, but it's also killing us. And it's killing the opportunities, the lives of our future generations. So to me, we're living a very dramatic paradox that we're all feeling, whether we can process it or integrate it or not.
Right. I've been reading Larry Rasmussen's book about basically eco-theology and the morality issues involved with climate change. And there really is this problem, which is that taking a shower and driving around and listening to music and computing and doing radio and stuff are not inherently immoral, and yet they're powered by fossil fuels at this point, and that's a big problem. But our individual actions, we don't feel them to be bad.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of activity in the climate world to figure out how do we feel these things personally. Mm-hmm. A lot of us have shut down with a sense of overwhelm and despair. A lot of us have ideas about what we can do and make personal changes, but many of us are actually not engaged on a collective level. Our collective capacity, our will to address this in a really concrete and clear way and a sustained way, it's very difficult.
Absolutely. Camila. Yeah. What excites me as a longtime climate activist about coal is that it elicits our courage by creating an arena where we see each other in a new way, as vulnerable people, as people without the answers, without always knowing what is right or wrong, but being part of this, you know, beautiful and very bloody world and needing to find a new way forward. That's what the story is about. How do we merge what we value in so many different ways and is sometimes often actually in conflict with each other? How do we muddle our way through that gracefully?
So you, Molly, and Little Globe, which is a whole team of people who are all about community engagement in lots of different ways, and all your projects are like this, came up with this idea of writing a musical. And tell us, without giving the whole thing away, but tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, it's been a really amazing journey. When I first started this project, I had just gotten the United States Artist Award, which is a national music award, and which was great and very surprising. And what it gave me was some finances and some time. And what I did was ask myself, what am I not taking on? As an artist, you know, I've tried to take on some difficult, murky areas in my work. And I'm usually interested in how does music open up spaces of exchange where we can feel ourselves in new ways, where we can see each other in new ways, where we can break out of habitual habits of relationship, which can be very dominated by lots of structures or people telling us who we are or, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. And I came across a book called Cole, A Human History. And it was written by a woman named Barbara Frias. And in the book, there's this great quote that said, this isn't the exact quote, but it's Cole is a story of creation and destruction. And it's the interplay between those two that is so compelling. And for me, that spoke to me as a mythical idea. And so that's where the musical started. I thought, well, I'm a composer. You know, what I do is write songs. You know, I do it in lots of different ways. But, you know, at the end of the day, I write music. That's what I really love to do. And so I started thinking about this kind of mythical idea. And, you know, I moved from New York City to, I'm from Colorado, but moved to New Mexico in 2001. And New Mexico's really changed me as an artist in many, many ways. But one thing I will say is that we've done all these different kinds of projects, but doing a full-scale musical or a national touring musical with the idea of that is nothing that I've done before. So the learning curve has been really, really high. And I knew from the beginning that I didn't want to do a traditional musical where the songs are, you know, often bursting right out of the scene of, you know, now I'm going to tie my shoe because I can't do anything else, you know, that kind of thing, which is wonderful writing and that kind of thing. But when I started the music, I called Luis Guetta, my good friend and collaborator, who's in Venice, California now, and we wanted to approach the music a little bit differently. We wanted the pieces to kind of stand on their own a little bit. And that's wonderful, and we created this soundtrack, which is really upbeat, and you know, people can hear the music on the website, which we can give later. And then we started looking more at the story. We kind of had this placeholder story, and I just don't recommend creating a musical in this way. I would do it differently now. But after some months, we ended up with a really wonderful, Akushal Bastable joined the team as the stage director and one of the leadership team members. And we ended up with a wonderful playwright named Georgina Escobar, who was our, I think, really third writer to come on the project. And we started creating this mythical world. And so the musical that people will be experiencing is a very upbeat kind of soundtrack. There's a world of two clans, the Brave Wings and the Wayfeet. And hopefully we'll see ourselves in all of them. And it's based around five central characters. Olam, who's a Wayfoot. The Wayfoot are people that are very, you know, very short-term thinking, but sort of ingenious masters of the material world. And the Brave Wings, which are far-seeing, kind of mystical beings, humans. The Weaver, who tends to the fabric of the universe. And Papu, who is Olam's grandfather, who was a miner who came up and became a mine owner, a very wonderful guy who has a very strong sense of family values and that kind of thing. And then there's an otter, and the otter is just this amazing, beautiful, funny character who's played by Charles Gamble, who's just doing such a great job. And we have actors in from New York City, Paul and Karen Kandel, who are award-winning Broadway actors. We have Elisa Jorge Garcia and Pat Moran in from the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Wow, so these are all going to be, I mean, you want this to be a national touring show, so you've got actors already from all over the place.
We do. Yeah, yeah, we really wanted a really great team, and then we have wonderful musicians from here, C.K. Barlow, Justin Bransford, and Joel Fadness. So, you know, on Friday night, you'll get a pretty good sense of everything, and it's a participatory night. There'll be a chance to really give feedback.
So that's the interesting thing about works in progress, is that the audience can see it, and then you can get a sense, you the artists and team of Cole the Musical can get a sense of how it affected them, what parts flew, what parts sank, and all of that, which I suppose you've been doing all along to some extent.
Absolutely, although, you know, this is our first public event, and Camila can speak more to this, but it's our first opportunity to start really talking with a lot more people, organizations, individuals, the audience. What do you understand? How can we use this to catalyze? And I'll let you speak to this, Camila, about the engagement, because it really is a big invitation to participation.
Right. Yeah, it's so exciting, I think, that we are focusing on story and on communication as the solution. Usually people hear climate change, they hear fossil fuels, and they think solar panels, and they think, you know, big national legislation. And yes, all that must happen, but our stories also must shift and evolve and become true to our times and to how we are now. And so in this reading, we're also going to take the opportunity to elicit feedback on, you know, which lines really stuck with you? What about this story rings true? What about it rings false? And how do we energize this movement for a new way forward, which the story gives us clues into, but which is also inside of every one of us, because it is an answer to the apathy, to the disempowerment, to the utter confusion, and as Molly said, this overwhelming sense that there isn't a way forward, when of course there is. We've gotten out of massive sticky situations in the past. You know, I was recently speaking with some World War II vets, and I thought about what it must have been like to live, you know, as a soldier during that struggle. Not every one soldier thought that they were going to win the war, and not every one American thought that, you know, if victory wasn't guaranteed, then the fight wasn't worth having. And from necessity springs invention, right? And I think that we're at that time. We just each have to see ourselves as the play challenge, or as the musical challenge us, as heroes. We're all heroes, and we need to be that for each other.
It's interesting when you talk about changing the narrative. First of all, narratives are really entrenched. We're still teaching the Iliad and the Odyssey, and with good reason. Mm-hmm. And some of the narratives that guide our own time, I mean, one of the main ones is growth is good. Mm-hmm. Economic growth is good. And just saying, no, growth is bad, you know, that doesn't really work. But we've got a big problem, and nobody knows what the new narrative really is or looks like.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm sort of part of a web of artists who feel like we spend some time, quite a bit of time, interpreting some of these really amazing activists and thinkers and writers who have been talking about this and really working hard to shift the narrative for many, many years, right? Vandana Shiva, Paul Hawken, you know, there's so many of them, David Suzuki. And, you know, it's been interesting this week because we have this song that's really not a song yet. You guys, everybody who comes on Friday will hear this, but it's kind of this play between the otter and Olam. Olam, who's coming from a family business and is very sensitive about being a provider for his community and providing jobs. And he's talking about the economy. And I remember David Suzuki was recently here and he said, well, the thing is, the market is a made-up concept. It's a creative concept in our minds, but air and water and clean, you know, is not
right.
And so we've got this kind of thing backwards, but we'll all swear by the market and what economic growth means. And so in this song, we're trying very hard to hit these kind of very critical small little points, but in a kind of funny way of, you know, economic growth, you know, lesson number one. And otter's kind of like, well, why do you want everything to be big? Because big things fall over easily, you know. And it's kind of goofy, and that's not all that funny when I say it at all. But you can see the direction that we're working with.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of people bringing forward. In fact, we're all bringing this new narrative forward. And that's the central idea of the engagement work, is that what we've found with this work quite a lot is that people will say, well, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do. Or, you know, I'm so overwhelmed, I'm so worried, you know, but I don't quite know what to do. And one of the things we've been talking about in the engagement team is, how do you provide a forum for people to engage that brings forward their own creativity, that is in line with their life, so something they can do with their family or friends or work or church or... and also give enough of a framework so that it's not just some open-ended thing like, oh, okay, here's a way to respond, send in your response or create a response. So Camila and Adam Horowitz and I have been working quite a lot on this. This musical, the way that it works is we're going to have a 3-4 site progressive premiere in February 2014, and Santa Fe will be one of the sites. So will San Francisco and probably a place in Pennsylvania. And 6 months before it goes up in a city, we'll start the engagement process in each city. And the engagement process really has a few very important elements that we think makes this a musical that acts very differently than traditional musicals.
6 months before the premiere in each of these cities, which will be early 2014, we're working with the name COL as an acronym to foster and support creative organizing and leadership fellows who will act as community organizers, merging the kind of more political realm with the purely artistic. So we'll kind of do a mapping exercise within each area that we land and understand who are the actors, right? If this is a play, who's the protagonist that we can work with? How do we invite people into the story before the musical is actually premiered so that they really begin thinking about, you know, how they, again, can become heroes, what's the questions facing that community. The story itself will be able to be downloaded so that one person with a guitar can download this story and convene their own community in both the questions and then some responses to generate movement pre-show and post-show. The fellows, these creative organizing and leadership fellows, will support anyone who wants to do that work. And that's why it's exciting to me. It's a very democratized model of change making, of storytelling, to really create this groundswell of enthusiasm and excitement and love, the things that really power us, not fear, not guilt. And so the show will really spark and kind of thrust that movement forward in San Francisco, in Santa Fe, in Philadelphia. We're looking at where extractive energy sources are pulled from the ground, their mind, how they're moved, and how they're burned. We really want to think about the whole process. And I think that our kind of national scope will reflect that.
And I think part of the really important idea about this engagement work that we're talking about is that anybody can become a Cole storyteller, and anybody can convene a group and tell the story and facilitate a creative response with their group in the way that they want to. And they'll be assisted with ideas and also really important questions that we need to ask ourselves, like, what do we care about in this circle, in our this little room, wherever that room is, and what impact do we want to have? So we have the opportunity to take personal and collective inventory, and we're asking people to work together for 3 months, and we're giving a framework 3 hours a week, you know, to convene a group of people and to create a response. And we're doing that because we have found that without that, it's too overwhelming for people.
Right.
We don't know exactly how it's going to work. We'll be refining this probably for years, but it's critical that people have a framework that feels doable to them and that they have some questions that help them find that courage and commitment and inspiration.
And, I mean, what you're talking about, it, I think, underlines the fact that for any national problem, and this is sort of the international problem of our time, is dealing with climate change. I think there's no one way to do it. It's like, okay, it's not just about finding the right technologies. Yeah, well, it is. And it's also not just about public awareness. Well, it's that too, and national legislation and changing your light bulbs and the arts. It's all of it. And it's everybody's awareness and everybody's participation to the greatest or smallest extent that they can, but we're all part of the whatever the solution is, which we can't even imagine fully at this point.
And isn't that exciting? That's the question I want to pose. Isn't that great that everybody can play a role, no matter how large or small, that it's all of us?
I love that too, and I feel like you know, every single person, this is what I feel like with Little Globe in general, is that we all have this incredible beauty. And in fact, we need each person to feel that they can participate in a meaningful way. That's imperative to the health of our communities and our world. And so, you know, with this project, we intend to the very best of our abilities to create that possibility and give everybody a chance to say, well, I can do this. I have this little thing I can do.
Right, exactly.
How can I bring that forward?
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about Little Globe.
Oh, great. Well, Little Globe started here in New Mexico in 2005, and Chris Jonas and I started it, and we're soon joined by Valerie Martinez and David Gallegos. And now we have a network of, gosh, many colleagues, artists, activists, cultural workers. People come from a lot of very diverse backgrounds in many, many ways of being diverse. And we typically run, I think right now we're running about 5 projects. We're a very small organization. We have a great administrative coordinator. We're doing work right now to get ourselves into a strong position where we can hire an executive director. Really excited to do that soon. But we're very grassroots, very dedicated and committed artists. Everybody works as a professional artist or organizer or, you know, some in the cultural field, cultural organizing field. And right now, for example, we're running Cole. We're running, Chris Jonas is running Turn the Lens. He just finished a beautiful statewide project of making a film with youth and community members from 7 New Mexico communities following kids trying to graduate from high school, and soon starting a project with a detention center in Albuquerque doing filmmaking with people who are about to get out of jail. And then we have Val Martinez is running the International District Project in Albuquerque, which is a large-scale community capacity and arts project that's long-term. We have a poetry project with kids in detention centers as well.
So continual ongoing community engagement.
Well, that's what we're devoted
with
to.
With art.
Yeah, we are very devoted to art as social transformation. And we're all very passionate about it. And we have been doing this work. Well, I've been doing this work probably since, well, maybe 1998. I kind of started this work. Yeah.
And Camila, you are from Oregon. You've just flown in, and you are a longtime organizer specifically around climate change.
That's how I began in college in Washington State. Most recently, I was in Arizona and Tucson involving the public in regional urban planning. And now back in my hometown, Ashland. And interestingly enough, I'm sort of living the story of Cole, as those who attend on Friday will see. The merging of these different values and worlds is what I'm actively trying to do, and I think that my generation is trying to do. I'm 25, and when the year I was born was when Dr. James Hansen, the premier climate scientist, declared to Congress that we had a major problem on our hands and we better do something about it. And so it's been my entire lifetime that not enough has happened. And so I take this very personally. It affects, you know, whether and how I have children, and you know, what kind of world is not left to quote unquote future generations, as people rightly say it's now. You know, I really think it's now. And so I'm really excited to be working with Molly and the Little Globe team on something that I feel is intrinsically worthwhile. It's not dependent entirely on what kind of change we make, although that is absolutely urgent that we do shift our world to something healthier. It's in and of itself beautiful, and it's in and of itself about community and the things that make us human and make us whole and make us happy.
The work in progress reading of Cole the Musical happens this Friday at 7:00 at the Lensic. Cold Musical is presented by Little Globe and the Lensic. Molly Sturges is artistic director. Camila Thorndike is director of engagement. For more information, you can go to colemusical.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank
Charlotte.
You.
Really appreciate it.
And we're going to go out with a little bit of the music from Cole the Musical.
Beautiful feeling, moving in the mystery of life. From the sun to the rose to the fox to the dung to the beetle to the soil to the beans to the person to the rain to the flower to the bee to the sparrow to the bear to the river to the sparkling seas.
Life sings within each one of us,
in between and all around.
We all float in the river of life, watching out for one another.
I'd like now to welcome Emily Kaltenbach. She is the New Mexico director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, what is the Drug Policy Alliance all about?
Well, we're an organization that works in the policy arena. We try to shift policies around drug misuse and abuse into the healthcare system from the criminal justice system. We also try to advance policies that reduce the harms of prohibition, because we know that a lot of people are being arrested for having an addiction or small amounts of drugs for on possession charges.
Or not even having an addiction.
Or not even having addiction. And ending up in our criminal justice system.
And so every year there are, both on a national level and on a state level, all sorts of noises made about the legalization or decriminalization of marijuana. And New Mexico has, what do we have so far? We have a medical marijuana bill?
We have a medical marijuana law that was passed in 2007. Great program. We have over 8,000 patients in that program. Medicinal cannabis has been incredibly successful in their lives in reducing pain and suffering for many serious illnesses. So that's been a huge step forward for our state.
Tell us more about that. What kind of illnesses is it treated for, and what have you actually seen?
So from MS to HIV/AIDS to chronic pain to individuals who are suffering from cancer, many patients who unfortunately are on hospice and in their last months and days of their lives, this medicine really is important to them and their families to relieve that suffering. There's also many patients who are on the program for PTSD, and those are veterans returning home from our recent wars who are suffering huge symptoms from those wars, as well as individuals like that have suffered from sexual trauma, and even some first responders in our state that you know also have PTSD from their exposure to trauma in the line of duty.
Do you think that marijuana is losing its stigma as being a kind of the drug of basically slackers?
I think there's a huge shift. There's a momentous shift that's happening across the country. And in the last 2 years, there have been some recent polling that shows that over 50% of Americans now believe in reforming our marijuana laws. And that also all the way from medical marijuana, which actually polls really high in this country, to taxing and regulating marijuana like is happening in Colorado and Washington.
Now, what actually is happening in Colorado and Washington?
So in November, on the ballot, there were two initiatives that proposes to treat marijuana like we do alcohol. So taxing and regulating the use, the possession of marijuana from an ounce or less, and actually creating a whole economy around it. And these states are going to see millions and millions of dollars in revenue. And we're also going to reduce the burden on our criminal justice system by not arresting and prosecuting people for having small amounts, tiny amounts of marijuana.
And so when you talk about taxing and regulating and having a marijuana-based economy and or the, you know, sector of the economy, what does that actually look like? I mean, will it be what alcohol is? You can advertise it in magazines. You can, you know, sell it in pretty packages in stores. I mean,
so there's a lot to be figured out about sort of what the rules and regulations will look like. So in Colorado, they actually have put together a task force that will determine how it will actually be regulated. And so, you know, in some cases, it may not be look exactly like alcohol, but the idea is that anyone who's 21 years or younger will not be allowed to purchase or possess marijuana like occurs now with alcohol. And there will be a whole licensing and taxing of a manufacturing system, an economy, so that individuals can purchase marijuana legally in their states. And so I think it'll look a little different in Colorado than it does Washington. So we'll wait for the next year to really see how those rules and regulations are determined.
And presumably some people will sell their specialty, which is organic, and some people will spray theirs with pesticides, and that will be reflected in the labeling and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see how this industry actually gets created in these two states. I mean, I just want to mention that these initiatives passed by an overwhelming amount. So it was about 55, 56% of the of those voters actually voted in favor. So this is even higher than the 50% I quoted that we're seeing nationally.
And so do we know what's going on in those states? Like if you, for example, walk into a bar, can you light up a joint?
So again, all of those sort of specifics are still being ironed out.
Yeah.
For example, in Washington, there's no public consumption of marijuana allowed. And so in some cases, that's already been defined in the initiatives that have passed. But we're going to see, again, the states develop their own rules and regulations for those initiatives.
Now, one of the things that is happening right now is that there is a memorial being considered right now in the New Mexico State Legislature to study the regulation and taxation of marijuana here in New Mexico.
So basically,
it's like, okay, let's see what these other states are doing and study what it would look like if we did it.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a study to see what the economic impact would be. And so it'll ask the department, New Mexico's Economic Development Department, to study both the potential revenues that our state could see if such a measure was put into place, as well as I had mentioned, the savings to the criminal justice system. So the savings, you know, if our law enforcement didn't have to spend time arresting and booking individuals for possessing small amounts of marijuana, they could deal with more serious violent crime that we know exists in New Mexico.
Right.
It would relieve the burden on our prosecutors and our public defenders and our court system. So there's a huge amount of savings that could be realized with the taxation and regulation.
Well, another savings, I don't know if this is right or not, but it seems to me that if marijuana were legalized, regulated, and taxed, a lot of the people who were drinking alcohol might switch to marijuana, and then your rate of violent drunken crime would also go down.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken sort of behind the scenes with lots of law enforcement around this to get their impression. And oftentimes they'll say, we never went to a call for domestic violence because of marijuana.
Right, but alcohol is probably off the charts.
Off the charts. And so, you know, I think, again, people, there's a tide shifting, but we're hoping that more and more voices will come out in support of this because everyone from our law enforcement to our court system to our healthcare professionals are realizing that we're wasting millions of taxpayers' money every year on this issue.
Very interesting. So there is this proposed memorial, which if it passes, it means there will be a study.
There'll be a study.
And then that study will be done in some period of time. What is it, just a year or more than that? Or?
It's in a year. The department will have to report back to the legislature before the 2014 legislative session with their findings.
Okay. And so we will find out about that. And if it turns out to be a tremendous potential economic driver for the state of New Mexico, then that's something that either the voters or the legislators will have to really start to deal with.
That's right. So then it becomes, it really will then inform future policy, whether that's next year or in future years. And I think we'll wait and see what happens in Colorado and Washington. We'll have a lot to learn about how they develop their systems so that we can follow in their footsteps in a good way.
Meanwhile, there is, I think, well, you can tell us about this, but it seems like there may be a coming clash between federal law and state law.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely still this inherent conflict between federal law because marijuana is still on Schedule I, which is still illegal under federal law. And so I think that's also what we'll wait to see what occurs in Colorado and Washington is what is going to be the federal response to this. Now, we were encouraged both in Denver and in Seattle when the city prosecutors dropped the pending cases of those individuals who had been charged with possession of under an ounce. And so we're hoping that will resonate, that the federal government isn't going to go after small users of marijuana. So we have a lot to see. We were also encouraged that the Obama administration remained very silent during the ballot initiatives that we saw in November, past November. So
that was encouraging.
That was encouraging, and they didn't come out in opposition. I mean, they made no comment at all, and so we will wait to see how the federal government decides to reconcile these state laws and the federal law.
We're talking to Emily Kaltenbach of the Drug Policy Alliance. She's the state director here in New Mexico. Now, there is another bill before the legislature that has to do with reducing penalties for small amounts of marijuana possession.
Yeah, so this is really a very modest bill. It's not earth-shattering. It's not unique. 15 states around the country have reduced the penalties for marijuana starting in 1973. With Oregon. So this is, as I said, nothing necessarily unique, but it would make a huge impact on New Mexico.
Now, reducing from what to what?
So currently, up to 8 ounces of marijuana is considered a misdemeanor. 1 ounce and below is a petty misdemeanor. But to most people, they'd say, oh, it's only a misdemeanor. But misdemeanors have huge collateral consequences and also include potential jail time. And so here are families that are being ripped apart, taken out of the job market, out of the economy, to serve potentially time for having, again, tiny amounts of marijuana. So this bill would reduce from 4 ounces of marijuana below, make it a civil infraction with just a fine.
Oh, okay.
And then all the way up to 8 ounces, take away the potential jail time.
So nobody would ever go to jail for possession of 8 ounces or less. And there would be a fine or misdemeanor and what? Probably not a very high fine.
Yeah, so that we reduce the fines in the draft legislation. So up to 4 ounces, it would either be $100 or $200.
Okay.
And then increasing fines from there.
Now, how are legislators lining up? I mean, is this a partisan issue?
Well, again, you know, I think we're seeing a tide across the country that this is no longer a partisan issue. It's no longer a third rail issue. And so we're hopeful to see bipartisan support of this. Again, it's about saving the state money and improving public safety. You know, our law enforcement officers deserve to have the resources to deal with more violent crime and not be pressed to deal with small amounts of marijuana. So we are hopeful to see bipartisan support.
So let's move on to some of the other kinds of bills that don't have to do with marijuana that Drug Policy Alliance is looking at. And one of them is a tax credit for providers of, how do you pronounce that?
Buprenorphine.
Buprenorphine.
Or otherwise known as Suboxone.
What is it?
The trade name. So buprenorphine is a medicine that's approved by the FDA. And not unlike methadone, most people have heard of methadone, it relieves the withdrawal symptoms and it also and the cravings. And it blocks the effects
of
heroin and prescription pills.
Okay.
And so the great thing about buprenorphine is that your primary care provider, if they're certified by the DEA, can actually prescribe it to you in pill format. Whereas in methadone, you go every day to get your methadone. Methadone's great and works for some people. Buprenorphine is a great alternative, especially in our rural areas where we don't have methadone clinics.
Right. And of course, heroin addiction is a tremendous problem here in the state of New Mexico.
Yeah, New Mexico leads the nation in overdose death rates. And that's more than twice the national average. And that's both from heroin, prescription drugs, cocaine. I mean, it's all the drugs combined. But when you look at the data, we're seeing a huge rise in both heroin and prescription drug overdose deaths.
Is heroin still the much bigger problem of those two, or is prescription drugs really?
Prescription drugs over the last couple of years, we're really seeing an increase in the use. But we have to remember that people actually transition back and forth between prescription drugs and heroin. So it's not that someone is just a prescription drug user and just a heroin user. There's really a lot of back and forth. And so we're really focused on opioid addiction because what's in oxycodone that makes the addiction so serious in those pills is also present in heroin. We're dealing with a very similar chemical structure, and so
right.
The addiction is very similar.
So basically, it would encourage providers to make this particular anti-addiction drug available. Do they get addicted to this new drug?
No.
Like methadone?
Well, I mean, there it definitely has to be regulated like any drug and like methadone is. But when used by someone who's suffering from addiction, what it really does is block those opiate receptors in the brain. And so someone can function normally. I mean, they can be function. They can go to their work. They can be part of their family. They can return to society and being really functional person. So it's a great medicine, just like methadone is. But unfortunately, there are very few physicians in New Mexico who are certified to offer this medicine. So this bill creates a tax credit to incentivize physicians to actually become buprenorphine providers.
Oh, okay. I would think that physicians who are dealing with drug addiction, that's a specialty in itself.
It absolutely is. But unfortunately, in our rural areas, sometimes we only have the family practice physician or the community health center. And so there's a huge burden on those physicians in needing to treat all sorts of issues, addiction included.
Now, there is another bill that the Drug Policy Alliance is looking at, and it has to do with harm reduction services. Mm-hmm. What's that about?
So New Mexico has led the nation in reducing the harm from drug misuse. And so when we're talking about addiction, which is so prevalent in New Mexico, there's some ways to really reduce the harms of those addictions. And back in 1997, we passed the Harm Reduction Act, which has led to syringe exchange programs and also the dissemination of a drug called naloxone or Narcan, which, not unlike an EpiPen, can be injected or in there's a nasal way, and it stops an overdose immediately. And okay. So we are hoping to get naloxone in the hands of friends and family who can be trained to actually administer this drug. And it has no potential for being addictive or any side effects. So it's really magic when it comes to reducing an overdose immediately.
And are we talking heroin overdose specifically, opioid?
Opioid, yeah, specifically. And so we've done a great job of the Department of Health has a program in which they train people to use Narcan. But unfortunately, as we've seen in all state budgets, their budgets have declined over the past couple of years, and our people are suffering as a result.
Yeah.
And so this appropriation would give them some additional funds to continue the work they do and expand it to get it in the hands of every family. We'd love to see Narcan, naloxone in every medicine cabinet around New Mexico.
Really?
It is. I mean, again, we have to remember that opioids can also, you can suffer an overdose by, you know, complete accident. If, let's say it's an elderly person who forgot, has a little bit of dementia, forgot when they took their last pill and takes another pain pill, and suddenly they're experiencing an overdose. So we think that naloxone is not only for those who are suffering addiction, but also to perhaps save a life of someone who mistakenly overdoses on an opiate prescription.
We're talking to Emily Kaltenbach. Now tell us about the Drug Policy Alliance as a national organization. What have been its priorities? And I mean, it seems like a pretty successful organization so far.
Yeah, an incredible. I feel very honored to be part of this organization, this advocacy group. We have offices across the country in California, Colorado, New Jersey, New York. We have a national office in D.C., and of course we have an office here in New Mexico. Some of our priorities as in very much aligned with what we've talked about today, reducing the harms of drug misuse and reducing the harm of prohibition. And so we've worked, my colleague up in Colorado worked very much on the initiative that just passed to tax and regulate marijuana. We've worked on doing other harm reduction efforts like the Good Samaritan Bill. Actually, New Mexico was the first to pass what is called the 911 Good Samaritan Bill, which means that if someone is witnessing an overdose and they call 911, they won't be prosecuted for possession.
Oh, okay.
And so we've then been replicating that law across the country. So my colleagues...
Now, has that worked?
Well, you know, that's
a
great...
Do people know about it?
That's a great question. I don't think enough people know about it. And so that's something that, you know, my colleagues in New York actually just passed a Good Samaritan bill in their state. And one of the pieces of advice I gave them was, please make sure there's money for education.
Yeah.
Because we can pass this law, but then no one knows about it.
Right.
And so I think we have a lot to do in New Mexico to actually teach people, inform people that this law exists, not only individuals, but law enforcement. so that they know that this is on the books, this is the law. And I think there's room to do some evaluation to say, is this really reducing, is it working? Is it the intent of the bill working?
Well, and also if you have, for example, police who are really intent on fighting the war against drugs, and somebody under the Good Samaritan bill makes a call, does that person then go on a list as somebody to watch out for later?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a database, but we know that that could easily happen, that yeah. those individuals then are targeted. I mean, we really, Drug Policy Alliance is fighting this war on drugs in the sense of, you know, we are wasting billions of dollars every year fighting a war that is really a war on people. And so as much as we can shift our funding and our resources from the criminal justice system into the treatment system and really, you know, start treating addiction as a health issue, not a criminal issue, allowing people to use small amounts of marijuana as long as it's not harming anyone else, these are the types of initiatives we're working on.
And again, I mean, as we touched on earlier, the vast majority of people who use alcohol and drugs don't become addicted to them.
Yeah, I mean, as we look at many substances, there are many people can use, but they're not misusing or they're not dependent.
Right.
And so but then unfortunately there are some that really do suffer addictions, and those treatment options should be there.
Exactly.
And to support them. And we should have treatment on demand. In this state, you know, there are mothers and fathers who say, I have to send my kids out of state in order to get the treatment they need. That's unacceptable.
Well, and then it becomes a class thing where whatever treatment you can afford is what you or your family gets.
That's right. Yep. So it's an issue. It's a class issue. It's a race issue. We're seeing, you know, the war on drugs is impacting communities of color disproportionately. They're impacting low-income communities. And so we're really hoping to advance policies that will end this war.
Is there anything you want to let the citizens of New Mexico know before we go?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about these issues that we think are hugely important to our state, to our state's economy, to families. So I would just implore that our voters and our citizens reach out to their legislators, tell them what they think about these issues. As these bills come up in session, we ask for people who are moved to call their legislators, ask them to vote in support of reducing penalties for marijuana, for studying, taxing, and regulating marijuana in our state, and also asking them to support addiction treatment. And we know that opioid addiction affects everyone in New Mexico. Our mothers, our grandmothers, our fathers, our children are dying from this epidemic.
Yeah.
And so we ask them to please vote in support of increasing addiction treatment.
Which I have to say saves not only lives, but really does save money in the long run.
Absolutely. So everyone benefits. The state benefits, the taxpayers benefit, our law enforcement officers benefit, and our families. So it's Senate Bill 343, which is the opioid addiction treatment bill, and Senate Bill 298, which increases appropriations for harm reduction. Those are the two that have bill numbers. And the other two, be on the lookout for the other two bills to support marijuana reform.
Emily Kaltenbach is the New Mexico Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. They are on the web at drugpolicy.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.